The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter and from the Harvard Health Letter. And the first thing I'm going to do is to finish up the article from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, that is the special report on race and health. The next subject that the article considers is community education. Black and white women have similar rates of new breast cancer diagnoses, but black women are 40% more likely to die of breast cancer. Aware of the disparate breast cancer outcomes for black women, two Mayo Clinic employees, Marion Kelly, the director of community engagement at Mayo Clinic in Arizona, and Michelle Halyard, a radiation oncologist and dean of the Arizona campus of the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine, got to work. In 2010, the pair formed the Coalition of Blacks Against Breast Cancer, which is CBBC, as a nonprofit to support breast cancer survivors, family members, and caregivers, and to provide breast cancer education to the black community. The organization hosts a monthly support group for breast cancer survivors and their loved ones, which is open to people of all races. To reach the community, CBBC teams up with black churches to host educational workshops. At every event, attendees hear a story from a survivor, learn the facts and figures about breast cancer in the black community, and are informed about the resources that CBBC offers. A good day for us is that we got the information out to a group of people that have not received it before, Kelly says. People who ask us for resources because they don't have them, and our ability to get them to a place where they can be treated, that's a success for us. At one community workshop, a woman raised her hand during the question and answer session and told the group that a mammogram had revealed a lump in her breast. After follow-up with the physician, she was slated for a biopsy, but she was scared and didn't follow through. It was now 2 years later, and she had skin lesions on her breast. She was in tears, saying, "I'm so scared that I can't do this on my own," Kelly says. Black women may be hesitant to seek care for a number of reasons, Kelly says, including fear of racial discrimination and lack of access to insurance and quality care. But in this case, the story had a hopeful ending. CBBC connected her with one of its ambassadors, who accompanied her to the appointment. The woman was then subsequently diagnosed with breast cancer and began her treatment. Solution in sight. Peyton Kerr's list of black women who have died prematurely continues to grow, unfortunately. She regularly gets phone calls from women sharing their grief at the loss of their family members. Equity is a life or death issue, she says. Whether we achieve it or not has very real consequences. But progress is possible, as organizations like St. Mary's Health Clinics, the Coalition of Blacks Against Breast Cancer, Mayo Clinic, and Peyton Kerr's own Foundation for Black Women Wellness illustrate. Today, Peyton Kerr has another list of names, women who have said that the organization has inspired them to improve and advocate for their health. She's encouraged by the progress, but like Mayo Clinic's Dr. Dubini, says that ending health disparities will require a larger, system-wide response. Disparities are the result of a long history of structural barriers and social injustice. The solutions to them require mobilization of an entire society to change them, Dr. Dobini says. Though the task is daunting, Dr. Dobini is confident it can be done. We know what to do. We know the interventions that will work. We know who is affected, he says. It comes down to our collective willingness as a society to make the investment, stick with it, hold ourselves accountable for the results that we desire. We can do it if we want to. The article goes on to ask, what can you do? Compassion and problem solving are needed in many areas of society, and the realm of healthcare fairness and equity is no exception. Here are some starting points if you would like to learn or do more. Donate your time, talent, or money to a local organization working for health equity. To find local nonprofits you're passionate about, read your local newspaper or use an online directory like Volunteer Match, which is www.volunteermatch.org. Engage in advocacy. Education, healthcare, and housing play a big role in health. Examine your own biases. You can take a quick online test that can help uncover your hidden biases on a range of topics including race, age, weight, and sexuality at Project Implicit. That's www.implicit.harvard.edu. Implicit is spelled IMPLICIT. You can also learn more about social determinants of health and health disparities by checking out several resources. One is the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Minority Health, which is www.minorityhealth.hhs.gov, and also the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, www.cdc.gov/social determinants. That's SOCIALDETERMINANTS. Now we're going to go back to the Harvard Health Letter and to an article called Caregiving During the Pandemic. Here's what they ask when email and phone calls are the main way to help loved ones in a long-term care facility. Managing a loved one's care in a nursing home or an assisted living facility has always been challenging, and it's harder now that visitation is extremely limited to protect residents from COVID-19. So how can you check on your loved ones, make sure they're being cared for properly, and let them know you're there for them? If your loved one is able to communicate well, a daily phone or video call is crucial. But remember that when you ask basic questions like, how are you feeling? Are you eating and drinking enough? Are you getting enough sleep? You may not get an honest answer. They may just tell you what you want to hear, says Dr. Susan Salomon, Associate Chief of Gerontology at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Do some sleuthing to get a more realistic picture. Listen to how the people sound on the call, Dr. Salomon suggests. Do they sound different, sad, or maybe confused, weak, or tired? Ask how they've been spending their time and who they've seen that day. Did they get outside of their apartment or room? Did they walk anywhere? Look for clues that they may be getting sick. Which staff in the facility may not have noticed? Talk to facility staff. Call or email facility staff to ask questions or advocate for your loved one. Start with the director of nursing or a caseworker. It's reasonable to tell staff you're worried and you may be asking more questions than normal. Find out how often they've been able to give you updates, Dr. Salomon recommends. Prepare a list of questions that include the following aspects of your loved one's health and well-being. Socialization. Ask if your family member is attending activities, if they're offered, or just staying in their room most of the time. If they're not getting out, ask about the plan to get the family member back into a healthy social and physical routine, says Dr. Suzanne Hartman, a geriatrician with Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Mood. Does the staff feel your loved one is generally in good spirits, or is there more sadness? Is it affecting your loved one's health or daily activities? Muscle strength. Is the family member having trouble getting up from a chair or feeling unsteady when walking? Too much inactivity can diminish muscle strength and potentially lead to falls. Getting into an exercise class or physical therapy at the facility or through home care could make a difference and reduce fall risk, Dr. Hartman explains. Eating habits. Is your loved one eating and drinking enough? What's the staff doing to encourage nutrition and hydration? A change in eating and drinking habits can indicate a change in mood and should be addressed by a doctor, Dr. Hartman points out. Medication regimen. Have any medications been added or eliminated recently, and why? Continence. Ask if your loved one is making it to the bathroom on time. Do they signal when they need to go, or do they soil themselves frequently? Dr. Salomon asks. If they're incontinent, what's the plan to address it? Hygiene. Is your loved one able to bathe, brush teeth, and perform other bathroom activities? If not, how often is the staff providing assistance? For example, how often are showers given? If you feel it's not often enough, what will it take to get care up to speed? Thinking skills. Ask the staff if they notice a change in your loved one's ability to reason or have a conversation. If so, ask if it might be linked to something fixable, like a medication side effect or a urinary tract infection. If you detect a problem, tell the staff about your concerns, especially if you suspect a new problem. If there's not a physician on site at the facility, ask them to arrange a telehealth visit with a physician, Dr. Hartman advises. Try to be on the call if possible. We do a group phone call with the older person as well as the caregiver. That's very helpful because you have a three-way conversation and everyone is on the same page. Some physicians, like Dr. Hartman, are able to make house calls to adult living facilities. Keep their spirits up. Social contact is important. Encourage loved ones to take part in activities at their facility. This is more challenging than it sounds because restrictions may change weekly, depending on the pandemic, Dr. Hartman says. But a lack of interaction has a devastating effect on an individual's thinking skills. And try to connect with your loved one in any way possible. Take advantage of visits if they're allowed, or drop off or send a care package, a card, flowers, or a picture from a grandchild, Dr. Hartman says. Social stimulation is the greatest way to combat the feelings of isolation and loneliness that so many people in facilities are experiencing. Now we're going to turn to another article from the Harvard Health Letter. This is March 2021 issue, and it's entitled, Coping with Relationship Fatigue. Too much time together makes for tense moments. Cutting each other some slack and setting ground rules will help. There is such a thing as too much togetherness at home, no matter if you're with a romantic partner, an adult child, a grandchild, or a friend. Because of the pandemic, we're frozen in place with people, but we aren't meant to be in the same space all day long, says Dr. Robert Waldinger, a psychiatrist with Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. Keeping the peace starts with understanding why you may be getting on each other's nerves. Then you can try following a few rules to get along better. Many factors may be contributing to the tension you're experiencing. Stress. We're all under an enormous amount of stress, the result of the pandemic, as well as the political and social climate in the United States. It's scary, and the anxiety is affecting relationships. We're all sadder or more anxious and on edge than usual, Dr. Waldinger explains. Close quarters. The limits of your home's footprint, even a large one, can be frustrating. It may not feel like enough space, and some people are living together in just a few rooms. You need space to get a break from each other, Dr. Waldinger says. Isolation. We're wired to be social animals. It's very upsetting not to see friends and family you're used to seeing. Generational differences. If you're living with adult children and their kids, you may find it hard to understand their behavior. Adult children may be bossing you around. I hear a lot of people saying that they're annoyed with teenagers whining about not seeing friends, even though people are dying in the pandemic, Dr. Waldinger says. Steps to get along. You can use a number of approaches to ease the tension at home. For example, cut each other some slack. When someone snaps at you, take a breath and remember that they, like you, are under more stress than usual, Dr. Waldinger advises. Balance closeness with distance. Find a place where you can take time away, whether it's your own little corner, another room, or a safe location outside the home. Set up boundaries. Agree to the times you can be together and times when you can be apart. Maybe come together for lunch and dinner, but go your separate ways in between, Dr. Waldinger suggests. Be sensitive to generational differences. Adult children may be telling you what to do because they're worried about your safety, Dr. Waldinger explains. And remember, the developmental task of teens is finding out who they are through friendships and romances. For many teens, being able to be with friends can seem more important than the danger of an infection. Let go of expectations. If we get annoyed with each other, it doesn't mean there's something wrong with the relationship. That's when cutting each other some slack is really important, Dr. Waldinger says. And remember, nobody is happy all the time. That's not a problem. Sometimes you're going to be gloomy. It's okay. Improve communication. Use I phrases. Find ways to communicate that don't accuse or find fault with others. Simply lay out a problem and ask for help solving it. For example, if it bugs you that dirty dishes are there long after someone promised to wash them up, say, "I'm in a bind. I don't know whether you're going to do them or if I should go ahead and clean up." That leads to better results than saying, "You're lazy," or "You're doing this to me." Talk about what's bothering you. When one person gets annoyed because the other did something trivial, like leaving the toothpaste cap off the tube, it's really just the tip of the iceberg. The iceberg may be an unspoken feeling that you're not heard when you ask something, to do things, or that the other person doesn't care, Dr. Waldinger explains. When you can talk about the bigger concerns, you have the chance to talk about what's really important. Get some perspective. You have the wisdom to know that life can be short. That can put things into perspective. Do you really want to argue about who's doing the dishes? Is it worth getting angry, Dr. Waldinger asks? Good relationships are worth the effort. For starters, they're good for your health. They ease the stress that gets translated into body processes like chronic inflammation, which can affect the cardiovascular system, joints, and brain, says Dr. Wallinger. And in the big picture, relationships will get us through these trying times, something Dr. Wallinger has learned as the director of the Harvard Study of Adult Development, an ongoing study that's followed hundreds of men and their families since 1938. When we look back at how people got through the crisis of World War II, people uniformly say the key was their relationships. That's something we should think about today. The next article in the Harvard Health Letter is called Bounce Back from Injury. Exercise and recreational balls can play an important role in recovery and pain reduction. A golf ball to ease foot pain, a kid's playground ball to recover from a knee injury. The combinations may sound foreign, but they're familiar approaches in the world of physical therapy. Here's how these tools of the trade can help you. A playground ball. This is the kind of inexpensive rubber or plastic ball, less than $10, that you'll find at a grocery or big box store. It's about the size of a soccer ball, but lighter. We commonly use that type of ball for knee rehabilitation. We'll have someone do mini squats against the wall with the ball between the knees. Squeezing the ball strengthens the quadriceps muscles, explains Claire Safran Norton, clinical supervisor of rehabilitation services at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. You can also squeeze this ball between your knees during bridge exercises as you lie on your back and lift your hips off the floor, which strengthens the gluteal muscles in the buttocks. Or you might use the ball to work your shoulders. Face a wall with your arm extended, pressing the ball against the wall with your hand. Move your hand in small circles, rolling the ball against the wall. That helps strengthen and add stability to your shoulder muscles, Safran Norton says. Even a game of catch with this type of ball is good for improving your balance and agility. You have to reach up, down, right, or left. You can do it while standing or sitting at varying speeds, Safran Norton says. An exercise or stability ball is a very large inflatable plastic ball used for balance, stability, and strengthening. This ball creates a moving, challenging environment. We'll often put someone on the ball once they've learned an exercise and they're good at it, Safran Norton says. Sitting and steadying yourself on the ball improves your core and balance. So does placing your shins on the ball as you do push-ups, or lying on your back on the floor, putting your feet up on the ball, then lifting your hips off the ground. You can strengthen your back, core, and balance by doing a bird dog exercise on the ball. You lie face down on top of the ball, then extend your right arm and left leg for a few seconds, then switch and extend your left arm and right leg. Exercise balls come in diameters ranging from 55 to 75 centimeters. Choose yours based on your height. The taller you are, the bigger the exercise ball. The balls cost $10 to $20. A tennis ball, or a rubber ball about the same size, is great for two types of recovery exercise. One is for the back. Take two tennis balls, put them in a sock, tie the end, and lie on top of it. You want to roll up and down against it with one ball on either side of the spine. It relaxes the joints of the spine and increases your flexibility. Using a tennis ball can also help relieve buttock pain from piriformis syndrome. That's pain caused when the piriformis muscle, deep in the buttocks, gets overstretched from too much sitting and irritates the sciatic nerve running through the muscle. Just sit on a tennis ball while you're on a chair or on the floor and roll on top of the ball while there's tenderness. The exercise works like a deep tissue massage with your own body weight applying the pressure, Safran Norton notes. Prices for a canister of three tennis balls start at about $5. A golf ball is good for foot pain, especially plantar fasciitis, an inflammation of the fibrous tissue that supports the arch of the foot. We have people sit in a chair, put the arch of their foot on top of the ball, and roll their foot over it, Safran Norton says. Because the ball is hard and small, it gets to the smaller muscles and breaks up scar tissue. Don't buy fancy golf balls. You'll find a package of basic ones for about $10 at a big box store. And the article also says, sit on your stability ball, rest your hands at the sides on the ball. Exhale as you lift your left knee and right hand straight toward the ceiling. Return to the starting position. Do this 10 times, then switch sides, lifting your right knee and raising your left hand 10 times. You can also use a lacrosse ball, a small, hard rubber lacrosse ball to help relieve pain in the iliotibial band, a long band of connective tissue that runs from the knee to the hip. The tissue merges with the gluteal muscles to stabilize the leg and can become irritated from too much walking or running. Stand with your side against the wall and lean against the lacrosse ball. Move up and down against the ball as a way to massage the IT band and leg muscles. Big box stores are a good source for lacrosse balls, which cost about $10 or less. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's issue of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I sure hope you enjoyed it.